Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
This episode of The Dirty Inning contains information from the following sources. Bib Falk, the man who replaced Shoeless Joe, by William A. Cook. Baseball Team Names, a Worldwide Dictionary, 1869 to 2011, by Richard Wirth. Pie Trainer, a Baseball Biography, by James Fore and David Proctor. Gateway to the Majors, Williamsport and Minor League Baseball, by James P. Quigel Jr. and Louis E. Hunsinger Jr. And The Cooperstown Chronicles, by Frank Russo. Welcome to the Dirty Inning Thanksgiving Episode Spectacular.
Gobble, gobble.
Thanksgiving, a holiday invented by people who came from the sea and the land dwellers brave enough to meet them for a steaming platter of corn or whatever. Trevor, Thanksgiving. Have you gone to get your Wawa gobbler yet? The stack of Wawa gobblers that you and your family consume on Thanksgiving Day?
I haven't gotten a gobbler yet this year, in part because like it's one of those, I'll get stuff from Wawa actually fairly often, but if I'm hungry on my way to work, Wawa is definitely one of the places I will stop. But a gobbler is just like so much of a commitment. Like you really have to be sure that you are not going to eat for like 3 or 4 or 8 hours afterwards. If you're going to get a gobbler. So no, I haven't yet, but you know what? I will say this. I have ordered my turkey. So, I have consigned an animal to death, as is the want this year, this time of year.
Right. That is the main goal of this. It's a part of Thanksgiving is reaffirming man's dominance over nature, in our ongoing war. And then, and being able to ritually sacrifice and consume the flesh of a large fat bird that is mostly helpless.
Had a good life in my case because I got it from a nice farm.
Oh, well, that's very sweet.
Yeah, it's not one of the ones that lived in like a cage.
Right, it's not one of the generic clone turkeys from the Wawa farm where they put them through the killing floor. Collect the seepings from a grate and then ladle it onto a bun of your choosing at the local Wawa. Wawa, not a sponsor of this podcast. Actually, requested specifically not to be mentioned. This is, of course, The Dirty Inning, a podcast that I habitually forget to introduce. But this is a podcast in which myself, Justin Clue, the managing editor of The Good Fight, and Dr. Trevor Strunk, a contributor to Baseball Prospectus, we discussed the most obscure, least laudable, most unpleasant, or raucously absurd innings in Philadelphia Phillies history. And friends, just when you think you've reached the limit of absurdities for this franchise, I got to tell you, you uncover a whole new branch. You find a whole new series of stories about, I don't know, for instance, a bunch of people with Thanksgiving-themed names who came through Philadelphia at some point or another.
I have a question for you, and I've thought about this a lot recently. Do you think this happens to every fan base? Do you think every fan base has these kinds of stories, or do you think that the Phillies are uniquely, let's say, equipped for this kind of podcast?
I would say, based on all of the research I've been doing, it feels for years now, for stories like this, for podcasts like this one, I think that it surprises me the most how much everything ties together and how much you see references to, like, knowing that baseball is this huge scope and that it's made up of all the great players, you've forgotten more of the great players who are like who created milestones in the sport, and then we're talking about little rinky-dink guys who showed up for a second or were barely there. In the grand scheme of things, you think it's impossible for stuff to connect as much as it does, but it really does. Baseball is just a rat king for a lot of – it's an inglorious way to put it, but that's because we touch on so many of the things that are less glorious than the moments everyone remembers.
So I
think that – other teams certainly have rich histories of this kind of thing. I'm sure looking back at some of the more storied franchises, the oldest ones like the Phillies, that, yeah, you're going to find a lot of stuff like that, and maybe you'll see differences and different trends and everything. But for the most part, I think a lot of teams just have different versions of the same types of stories.
Okay.
I'm sure there's some outliers, and I'm sure the Philadelphia franchises we talk about that they have outliers as well, but I don't know. Yeah, for the most part, my theory is that this has all been done, and this will all happen again. You know, this has all been done before, and it'll all happen again. And
very Matthew McConaughey of you.
Yeah, this will probably surprise you to learn, Trevor, that the Philadelphia Phillies have never played a baseball game on Thanksgiving. Isn't that crazy?
Has anyone ever played a baseball game on Thanksgiving?
Funny you should mention that. No, which is just wild to me. But I do, before we get started here with the topics we're going to discuss here on this special episode of The Dirty Inning, Trevor, what's your favorite Thanksgiving food?
That's a good question, Justin. I think more and more, I say this, the actual answer is 100% pie, and particularly like apple pie. But more and more I have become like a guy who likes stuffing. I think stuffing's very good, and I think stuffing is extremely underrated. I've always been a mashed potatoes guy. I've never really been a big turkey guy. I'm making the turkey this year, which I mean doesn't really affect me one way or the other in terms of my preference for it. I've just never really been a turkey guy. I could do the whole holiday without it.
Does that mean that, like, because you're making it this year, you're like, oh, you know what? I'm going to do it right. I'm going to do it the Trev way. I'm going to stuff it full of M&Ms the way I've always intended. I'm going to show these people what they've been doing wrong the past few decades.
I made it last year too, and I'm going to make this, and it's finally going to be like the not the pie. I wish. It's finally going to be the,
you just like, all right, the turkey's done. You bring out a platter of many pies and everyone's like, what are you doing? You're just like, go ahead, eat up, passing out an individual pie to each person. They're just,
who's ready for turkey?
Everyone eat your pies.
Turkey pie. Although I actually did suggest maybe we'd want turkey pie this year, like chicken pot pie. And I was told that was not a good idea.
Trev, how often around the holidays do you get told to just fuck off?
Pretty often.
Yeah, I bet. With ideas like that coming out of your mouth.
Right. Yeah, shut up. I tried to make it so that it was like the kind of turkey I would like. And it didn't work. Like, I just don't think I'm like a huge turkey guy. And everyone, like, I was like, oh, geez, sorry, everyone. This turkey didn't turn out very well. Like, no, it was really... They were like, it's really good. Like, we like this turkey. And I was like, are you kidding? Like, it's not very good.
You would be.
Like, no, this is a really good turkey.
You're just like, in full teenage Trev goth garb serving everyone turkey. Like, I'm sorry, everyone. The turkey didn't turn out very well. And they're like, no, it's fine. You're like, no, I blew it again. And you go stomping upstairs and they can just hear your music muffled coming through the floor as the.
That's right.
Fixtures shake, yeah. Another banner Thanksgiving at the Strunk House. I almost said the Dr. Strunk House, as if your family name is Dr. Strunk.
That's what they call it now. I thought of you because you're maybe the only person who consistently calls me doctor. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly including myself. I'm not. But I was watching a mystery, like a British mystery, and one of the characters in it, you find out has been like is the murderer. And he is he's also a professor, and it's a surprise that he's the murderer. And this guy like surprises him as he's chasing down the main detective. And he's like, Mr. Such and Such, what are you doing? And he goes, it's Doctor, and shoots the guy in the chest, killing him. And I was like, man, I would never do that. I don't think I'd ever kill someone.
You had to tell yourself, I had to see it on video, but now that I have, I can officially say that I would never shoot someone for getting my title wrong.
You know, I mean, it's an important thing to ask yourself. What would happen if someone got my title wrong? Would I end their life? For me, the answer is no. Wow. Justin, what's your favorite?
Well, we talked about this on Hidden Season, and the fact that you said stuffing is pretty monumental, given that Liz Rocher said that it was her least favorite Thanksgiving food.
Goodness.
And she hates it. And frankly, it caused a rift that I'm not sure the podcast will ever recover from. So I'm glad you were able to step in and say that you like stuffing more than anything. I said mashed potatoes because I'm a big mashed potatoes fan.
Yeah, mashed potatoes are very good. I think, like, if I gun to my head, I want to say stuffing.
And there
it's
like, is.
It's new. Oh, yeah, and there's a gun to my head that I am holding there because I missed my title up.
It's Thanksgiving, after all.
No. It's like, if gun to my head, I'd probably say mashed potatoes because I really, really do love mashed potatoes. Did you know that when I was a kid, I'm just asking if I told you the story. I'm sure you don't know because you were there, but
I was.
When I was a kid, my mom would make me dinner, and she would pretty much make me what I wanted. And usually, what I ended up wanting was mashed potatoes for dinner. So she would make me like six or like you know 2.5 pounds of mashed potatoes, and that's all I would eat for dinner.
Wow. That's impressive. 2 pounds of mashed potatoes. Good for you. Good to, way to handle that. That's a hefty portion, I would say.
That's right. Do you think you could eat that much?
Oh, I could put that away. Absolutely.
Yeah, you could.
I'd take that. Massive pile of smashed root vegetables to task. You better believe it.
You gaining weight, buddy?
Yeah, please. That's called a salad where I'm from, which is a place where we don't know the correct definitions of terms. Well, Trevor, as a follow-up question, you said you weren't a huge fan of turkey, but I need to ask, you do eat turkey on Thanksgiving. So how do you like your turkey? Grilled, roasted, slow-cooked, light meat, dark, still alive as you start to eat it? Tell us.
Yes, usually alive, and if anything, I like that scientists have been able to make the turkey vocalize its mm-hmm, suffering. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It makes the meat sweeter for me.
Absolutely. Knowing that something died in pain for your pleasure. Yes, that is a huge part.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's correct. The classic sort of thing of roasted, I guess. Like, I definitely enjoy a good, like, you know, oven roasted turkey. I think I brined it last time and it came out pretty well. I think I'll probably try that again. I didn't brine it. I put butter under the skin. Like that's good for me. Like the thing that sounds most grotesque.
Yes. But, I removed the turkey's skin. I like to think about how Thanksgiving sounds to a turkey who can understand English. And when you just realize you're just ripping off the skin of something that used to be alive and smearing butter underneath it. And they're just like, this is, imagine a horror movie, but once a year is real. It's basically, Thanksgiving is the purge for turkeys, essentially.
Yeah, that's correct. Because mm-hmm. Crime is legal.
Right. Crime against turkeys.
Yeah, crime against turkeys is legal. Yes. Other crime is not legal on Thanksgiving, as it happens. So don't try and commit it.
Found that out last year.
You'll get in big trouble.
Don't forget about that gun to Trev's head.
But I like dark meat, I guess. Like I like a good drumstick.
Thank you for answering my question. That is clearly a setup for a larger point. And thank you for answering it so succinctly. I don't think the thread of baseball is, I don't think people have forgotten this podcast is about baseball at all. So,
I was going to ask if you were being sincere. Now I realize that certainly you're not.
Why do you think I'm holding this gun to your head? Well, Trev, in the 40s, the Phillies liked turkey too. But they liked their turkey terrible and violently racist.
That sounds Phillies-esque. I buy it.
Friends, meet Cecil Washington Tyson. His nick.
Do we have to?
Only if you're in the, yeah, not, no, you don't have to. Only if you were playing in the New York Penn League in the 40s during World War II. His nickname is listed as Slim, but clearly Turkey was the name he went by. It's the name he's listed as in Baseball Reference next to an avatar in which he's wearing an oversized ball cap with a D and giving a toothy grin between his misshapen eyeballs. Frankly, this person has quite the reputation in baseball history, even if you aren't familiar with his work. That is because he had one single major league at-bat, Trevor. And that, you'll never guess for which baseball team that one single at-bat came to the
Cleveland Spiders.
Oh, so close, but incorrect.
The Cleveland Spiders.
I'm gonna double down on Cleveland Spiders. The one major league at bat for Turkey Tyson, of course, occurred for the Philadelphia Phillies. It happened on April 23rd, 1944. He hit what Baseball Reference calls a fly ball to third base, which. I'm not sure if that's the correct way to phrase that, or if something happened, there was a miscommunication between scorekeepers or what, because I don't think a fly ball, I mean, I don't think it can get.
Boy, outside of the time when baseball didn't have foul territory, which certainly was before this happened.
Right.
I can't imagine a fly ball to third base.
Well, he was.
Was his nickname Turkey because of Tyson turkeys or?
No, and that's chicken, isn't it? Tyson chicken?
I figured they probably made turkeys too, but yes, I mean, it's mostly chicken, yeah.
Anyway, yeah. On either side of that single at bat at Braves Field in Boston on April 23rd, 1944, in which he went 0 for 1 for his entire major league career, Turkey Tyson has an illustrious minor league career. He started playing baseball professionally in 1938 at the age of 23 and would play over a decade into the 50s. And that single at bat in Boston, yeah, that's the center point of a career that a lot of historians are going to be citing because it happened in the minors. It happened in the 40s before, you know, a lot of this stuff is written down somewhere that people can find too easily. But we do know some basic facts about Turkey Tyson. One is that he really had no business playing Major League Baseball and really didn't even have much business playing professional baseball. He was in the major leagues and filling out a roster in the minor leagues because of World War II and all of the good baseball players being unavailable.
Nice.
Because they were playing in World War II. So...
It's kind of messed up that you would call it playing, but okay.
They were fighting, fighting in World War II. Wow.
Please don't take that out.
In Turkey Tyson's case, we do know that, yeah, he was just the next man up. And the 2003...
The next man up who, curiously, was not fighting in the war.
The 2003-2004 Cooperstown Symposium on Baseball and American Culture called Turkey Tyson a tobacco-spewing bigot. So that kind of tells you where this story is going, and it gets there in a very big hurry. Now,
I love our episodes in this era because almost always the phrase tobacco-spewing bigot is relevant.
So common, yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, you talk about American culture. That's a big swath of it.
We're basically back there. We're just doing it now again.
So one of the owner strategies of these World War II era teams was to sign players from Latin America to fill out their rosters. And in 1944 and 1945, the Washington Senators signed a bunch of players from Latin America, chiefly from Cuba. And many of these Cuban players came to America and they wound up playing on the Senators' farm team, the Williamsport Grays. And in fact, there were so many that they had to buy a Williamsport farm, or at least use a Williamsport farm, for all of these Cuban players to live on. So the Williamsport Grays were, in their history, this is
literally
actually
a farm team.
This is they were Literally.
You didn't think of
that. I'm glad I didn't write that down, because if I had come up with that and then you just cut me off and said it, I would have just stopped recording and ended the podcast right there. That would have been really upsetting. But fortunately, I'm not that clever. And they were a literal farm team. And this in their history is known as like the Cuban years, where they were made up chiefly of Cuban players. And unfortunately, not every team in the league reacted well to seeing players from another country on American soil playing America's pastime. And the Utica Blue Sox were known for being a bunch of dumbass, soft-brained, untalented, racist jabronis. And they, of course, would have to play the Williamsport Grays. And during those games, they let their not-so-inner, dumbass, soft-brained, untalented, racist jabroniness come out heavily. So
let their freak flag fly.
Turkey Tyson, in fact. The incident we're going to discuss took place on July 8th, 1944. And according to that same Cooperstown Symposium, can be, quote, traced directly back to his Cuban baiting, talking about Turkey Tyson. And it's not.
Man, Cuban baiting. That's so mean.
Yes. And it was July 8th, 1945. Forgive me. I misspoke. This was a little more than a month after a water boiler explosion in the clubhouse of the Williamsport Grays had injured a few of their players. So they were down even. This was a replacement team that was now down a few guys because of an explosion. So these were dire times in baseball when the Washington Senators.
Did they die?
No, there was just some injuries that were incurred from that. But no, this is a time in baseball history.
Like a little worried about that.
When the Senators needed to fill out their roster because of a world war going on that a bunch of their players were off fighting in. And in doing so, brought a bunch of players Whatever. From Latin America into an extremely hostile environment with a bunch of racist white players. And then a water boiler exploded and took out some more of their players. Like, these were dire times for baseball.
It's almost like baseball should have just like said, okay, until the world war is over, we're just not going to have baseball.
Yeah. Like, let's just call this what it is and take a couple of plays off here, because this is getting a little absurd.
I like imagining the idea of like a true nationwide draft now. And there being like, a bunch of people be like, okay, so how are we going to keep the NFL, NHL, and MLB going? Well, I don't know.
It's important to keep.
I think we really should.
It's important to keep people's spirits up. And what better way?
You got to keep the morale up.
But what a better way?
No one's asking to see more about the Phillies.
What better way to keep people's spirits up than the sports they spend their lives being furious about and screaming at each other in regards to? Well, Trev, on July 8th, 1945, the Williamsport Grays and the Utica Blue Sox were playing in Williamsport. And so in this game, a pitcher for the Grays named Leo Goycochea, who was one of the Cuban players. And yes, he was. There were plenty of moments of tension during this game. And in one of the innings, Goycochea is facing Turkey Tyson. And there's already been some problems and everybody's, there's some tension simmering. And Goycochea strikes out Turkey Tyson to end the inning.
take that, Turkey Tyson.
Well, he didn't take that, Trevor. And instead he ran towards the mound.
I encourage it.
Immediately. And had gotten into a fight with Goycochea. Blows were exchanged, and suddenly all the players were off the benches and on the field. Fans were crawling over each other to get off the stands and under the field. And it turned into an all-out brawl that had to be broken up by the cops. It was just a brutally awful, awful moment that Turkey Tyson started just because he wanted to, basically. He just was like,
Was anyone on the side of the poor Cubans who were being like completely attacked for no reason? Or were most of the people like Turkey Tyson heads?
Well, there was a lot of, some of the people were using it as an excuse to just be in a brawl. There were a lot of Cuban players on the Williamsport team that all had each other's backs and were well aware of the Utica team's reputation, and also later on lauded Goycochea for hitting Turkey Tyson, who is a particularly vocal member of the racist side. But to answer your question, another member of the Blue Sox, who was like just as bad as Turkey Tyson, his name was Bill Shadler. He got into a fight with one of the Cubans in front of the Williamsport Grays dugout. The thing is, that Shadler was also on the Williamsport Grays. So he got into a fight with his own teammate just because he was racist. And several days later, he did that again with one of his Cuban teammates. And then that happened in Binghamton. And finally, at that point, the executives of the Williamsport Grays decided that Shadler was, you know, it's time to throw him a little indefinite suspension his way.
Maybe a bit of a loose cannon.
We like his passion, and we're willing to forgive him attacking some of his own teammates because of their race.
Wow, why'd we lose, Skip? Well, we got a big DL stint right now. Why is that? Because Shadler beat a bunch of guys up.
Trev,
you gotta love his intangibles. I mean, you know, Justin, you've picked a really wonderful topic here because you can't really have Thanksgiving without racism.
Or,
insofar as it's like, it's a pretty rough holiday if you sort of like bother to historicize it. And like, I'm glad that we're sort of getting in a lot of the American verve for just being terrible.
Yeah. And this, make no mistake, this was a terrible man. A little more than a week later, back at Utica, once again, the Grays and Blue Sox were playing each other. And once again, Turkey Tyson got into a fight at first base with Grays pitcher Danny Parra. Once more, bench is clear. On this day, the fight gets broken up and everybody goes back to their corners. And Turkey Tyson lives to be racist another day. But one quick side note, this game was later won for Utica on an RBI by a young man named Richie Ashburn. Gasp. Hooray.
Why were the Phillies farm team in Utica?
Yeah, the Utica Blue Sox were the Phillies Eastern League affiliate at this point. Their manager was Eddie Sawyer. A name from Phillies lore as well. So yeah, that was a miserable little chapter for old Turkey Tyson. However, the Grays were finally at this point they were pretty rattled by all the hate in the league, and they suffered from their record suffered and their play suffered because their record really just they plummeted at that point in the season. And the legacy of Turkey Tyson, a man who played for the Phillies for one at bat, was clearly a miserable shit of a man, and actually played for the Phillies for that 2 year, 1 to 2 year period that they were known as the Blue Jays in 1944 and 1945. Oh, wow. So yeah, just a real monster. But fortunately, not the only player named Turkey to ever throw the old baseball around, Trev. Another young man by the name of Turkey Gross also came through Philadelphia at one point.
Yeah, that's what I call Turkey.
Well, on behalf of the Dirty Inning, I apologize for Trevor's inappropriate humor, frankly.
Turkey Gross.
But no, Turkey Gross played for the 1925 Red Sox, a baseball team that sucked. They went 51 and 101. And Turkey Gross was a shortstop for them for 9 games. Yeah, he got 32 at-bats on the major league level. Turkey Gross had a less hateful legacy, you might say, than Turkey Tyson. Good. He never played for a Philadelphia team, but he did play in Philadelphia for four of the 9 games he played as a big leaguer against the Philadelphia Athletics. So Turkey Gross debuted in Philadelphia against the Athletics in a game in which the A's blew a 6-0 lead the Red Sox blew a 6-0 lead, his own team. Yes. So that was a hell of a debut for him. And it mostly happened in the bottom of the 8th inning. When the Red Sox, they were up 6-0 through the first 6 innings of the game, the A's came back, scored 2 runs in the 7th inning. So in the bottom of the 8th, the A's are behind 7-2 still at this point. And they hit 2 singles to lead off, and then a guy named Frank Welch hits a home run to make it 7-5. And then there's a double.
Cool.
And then finally, the Red Sox managed to get 2 outs, but then Jim Poole hits a single, scoring Bill Lamar, the guy who hits a double. A guy named Chick Galloway gets on base with a walk, and finally the inning ends. But the Red Sox
Chip Galloway gets on base with a walk right after releasing his hit jazz album.
So warbling on a saxophone, he heads back to the dugout. And in the top of the ninth, the Red Sox make something of an effort to stem the tide with a Joe Harris home run leading off the top of the ninth. In the bottom of the ninth, it's Bill Lamar who comes back, and he hits a single to right field. Well, first of all, the inning starts off with an error on the shortstop, a throwing error. So the leadoff hitter, Sammy Hale, gets on board.
What's your favorite kind of error, Justin? Is it a throwing error?
What an excellent question. I guess a throwing error, because it can compact the original error of a play. Like when guys are in a hurry, they race to get the ball and then throw it, and it's terrible.
Yeah, that's a really good
yeah,
one.
Yeah, there's such a little league component to that I think is awesome. I like errors where the ball goes off the glove and into the stands.
That's a good one, where it comes a ground rule double all of a sudden.
I will say, to answer your question definitively, I love errors where the fielder doesn't know where the ball is. That's my favorite. Like, not like it rolled under the fence and they can throw their arms up. Like, not like that where there's a get out of jail free card like that. I mean, like, the ball gets stuck to Yadier Molina's chest plate and he's looking around all for it and can't find it because it's stuck to him.
Oh, somehow. No.
Or, yeah, that kind of stuff. That is without a doubt the highest quality error, most certainly.
I like the kind where, I mean, you're probably right. Like, I think ultimately that is correct. But I do think something can be said for the error where, like, basically the guy is trying to get the ball or something like that. Like, generally it happened at, like, second base. And it'll be an easy thing, and then it'll just like bounce off their glove or something, and their face just falls completely, and it's just like, oh man.
Right.
You just basically get to watch someone just go, darn it.
You just watch the light go out of somebody's eyes as they like try to make a sharp play on a ground ball that they've made 1,000 times before, and then realize they're just not going to do it this time. Oh yeah. That's the good stuff.
That is one hot error right there. Absolutely.
Well, in Turkey Gross's debut, yeah, like I said, the Red Sox were in the middle of losing it for him despite having a 6-0 lead early on. And yeah, Sammy Hale reaches on a throwing error by the shortstop. The next hitter, Max Bishop, reaches on a walk. Then Red Smith steps up, and he sacrifices them both over into scoring position. At that point, Bill Lamar steps in. He hits a single to right field. Then Hale scores, and Bishop both score, and they're both unearned because of the original error in the inning. And nice. Because of that, the score is now tied 8-8, and the Red Sox do nothing in the top of the 10th, despite a leadoff single and an error on the. I keep almost calling them the Phantoms because their abbreviation is PHA, but it's the Athletics. The Philadelphia Athletics.
It's pretty cool how the AHL can also play really good baseball. But you know, this podcast has long said that hockey is the ultimate sport played by men.
Minor league hockey, yes.
Yeah, only my, yes, of course. Major league hockey is only for fools and charlatans and traitors.
I say that all the time. I've been told to stop saying that, mostly by Wawa. So there's a leadoff single and an error on a ground ball, but yet somehow the Red Sox managed to not score because their three outs are like the three most pathetic outs. A foul bunt pop up. And then two strikeouts to end the inning on three pitches.
A foul bunt pop up. Wow.
Yeah.
That's such a like a dead ball era strategy to be like, oh sweet. We got someone on base. Better do a bunt now. We're like, we have the bases juiced. We got a bunt.
How's he ever gonna get to second base? Has anyone ever gotten to second base? It's so early in baseball history that I don't know the answer to that question. Well,
almost certainly not. No one's ever been there. It's a mythical place.
In the bottom of the 10th, I almost called them the Phantoms again. The Athletics mount their comeback. They get a leadoff single. They get a single that puts that runner on third base. And then Sammy Hale, who factored so prominently into the last two rallies, steps up. It's a ground ball single to third base. Must be racing the infielder and reaches first base in time that allows the leadoff guy to score. And in Turkey Gross's debut in Philadelphia against the Athletics, his team blows a 6-0 lead late in the game against a Philadelphia Athletics team that I mean, this was on opening day, so this was at
brutal. That At, I mean, that's like shades of Kapler.
Yeah, at Shibe Park on opening day, and just a brutal loss, but not for the home team, just for the guy
named Turkey. Well, that's cool then.
I guess, you know, Turkey's appearance in this game was minimal. He did get.
I was going to ask.
Yeah, mentioned that the man named Turkey, who we're bothering to discuss, he did get three at bats. He reached base on an error earlier in the game. There were four errors in this game, by the way. The Athletics committed three of them. But yeah, Turkey Gross. He reached base once on an error. He was hit by a pitch in his first at bat.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That sucks.
He also hit a triple to left field. Yeah. Whoa. Yeah. So he had a hell of a day.
Yeah, really? That's pretty good.
Like, for his debut.
Oh, triple? He only had like seven other at-bats, right? Like this is basically the end of his career.
Well, in his final at-bat, he grounded out to shortstop, but then he had to go, you know, sell programs and beer in the concourse because that was his second and third jobs before he went to the salt mines after the game. So, yeah. It was a pretty hectic day for young Turkey Gross, who would go on to play in eight more entire baseball games.
I never get it when someone hits like, and I guess like Don Brown did this too, but like I never get it when someone hits like a triple in their first game, and they're like, and he played in three other games. Like, didn't someone think like the guy who hit a triple in his first game is worth a shot? Like, did no one want to give him another shot?
I mean, I would have given it to him. Like, yeah, like that's the guy who got on base three times. He had an extra base hit in his first ever major league. I think that's come on. Why didn't?
I mean, this is why both you and I would be terrible, like terrible baseball people, like terrible people to own a team, because it would be like we'd be like, well, look at this guy's box score. He got on base three times in that game. He's got to be worth something. Just sign into a max contract or whatever. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting you mention this because this is part of his story. The two runs he scored in the first game he ever played were the only two he would ever score in his career, even though, as I said, he appeared in more games. Unfortunately, it became clear quickly that he was pretty overwhelmed on the major.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Apparently.
Now I feel bad for him. That's a shame.
Yeah, he had apparently shown all of this. They were very excited seeing him play down in the South, where the minor leagues where he was playing, and unfortunately, as we read in his biography on Sabre, that one of his coaches had said, "quote No one could guess that Ewell Gross, which is like Turkey Tyson, Turkey Gross also had a real person's name, and it was
Ewell. Ewell. Is that a real person's name?
Gross, which
Ewell, yeah. like Ewell Brenner,
spelled E W E L L. What is the way that would be?
So no, so not like Ewell Brenner,
but like his coach Mel Webb said, no one could guess that Ewell Gross, who did so well in the short field, would blow up or rather fade away as soon as the pressure of the league racing was applied. So yeah, that was kind of the end of him, unfortunately. But he did give us a second major leaguer named Turkey, and he did, you know, he did have a real name, and it was Ewell. And Trevor, you know what? He did go on to he stayed in baseball, and he went on to manage a minor league team called the Lone Star City Rustlers, named after the high number number of cattle thieves in the area at the time. And
do you think there's a Rustlers T-shirt we can get?
I'm almost positive, yes. You know,
I mean, I want
just
one.
check out our T-shirt store. $30 a piece for T-shirts of the lowest quality. It's actually from 1925, so it's, you know, it's made out of burlap. Well, Ewell Gross managed to, yeah, he managed this team called the Lone Star City Rustlers, which oddly enough was noted to be that the team was known as Ewell Gross's Rustlers, which I don't know if it counts as a nickname if you're just saying what
it's not super catchy.
What it is, you know, like you're just saying the thing that it is.
You may as well just call it like the Rustlers then. I mean, it's not any more catchy than just the name you've already given.
Yes, totally. I don't understand how that came to be.
That's
nicknames
strange.
Back then, much lower bar, I would say, certainly.
Charlie Manuel's Philadelphia Phillies.
Well, after two helpings of turkey, Trev, we're going to move on to the stuffing. And that is, Stuffy McInnes, who we all know from Phillies. He's a much more prominent name, I would say, to baseball historians than either of the turkeys we've discussed here today. But, you know Stuffy, Trev. Hell, we all do. And no, I don't mean Stuffy, the guy who sits at the end of the bar you frequent in your suburban Philadelphia neighborhood who quietly cries every time Lola comes on the jukebox. I'm talking about Stuffy McInnes, the first baseman in Connie Mack's $100,000 infield. And I think you knew that.
I didn't, but, thanks for clarifying, because I was wondering how he played some baseball. Cried too much.
Well, Stuffy got his shit together. And he had a long, illustrious career playing for the Phillies and playing Major League Baseball. He started with the Philadelphia Athletics in 1909. He was with the Red Sox in 1918 until 1921. At this point, it's the end of his career is within sight. He goes to the Boston Braves. He winds up on the Pirates for a little bit. His last ever listed Major League playing occurred for the Philadelphia Phillies, and that wasn't really
cool.
He was a player manager at this point, except he was not playing at all. In fact, he's listed as being in this game. He did not get an at bat. He did not get a plate appearance. He didn't do anything except enter the game as a defensive replacement at some point. But it was going to be his last game. So he kind of just suited up for it in a romantic farewell sense. He was in the middle of driving the Phillies to a 51-103 last place finish when
he decided
to just lace up, Trev, play some big league ball one last time.
I really like the pathos of putting yourself in as a defensive replacement.
This is really hard. I can see why you were having such a bad time out here. Crap.
Stuffy, please let us die.
This is really rough going. We should really be wearing bigger ball caps. These are really tiny early 1900 ball caps we're wearing, and I frankly find it ridiculous. The name's Stuffy McInnes, and I'm going to fix this sport. Anyway.
I like that character.
For his last game at Wrigley Field, Stuffy McInnes and his Phillies lost a real heartbreaker to the Chicago Cubs. They lost probably in one of the more heartbreaking ways you can lose, Trev, which is you go down early, you mount a heroic late-inning comeback to tie the game up and really stir the idea that, yes, you know what? We thought we sucked today, but actually, no. We are a team of friends, and we are going to come together, and we're going to make this happen, even though it'll only be our 38th win of the season on August 1st.
That's beautiful, Justin. Is that what happened?
And then they lost. And they lost the next inning after they did that. And we'll break down that inning real quick, dirty inning style. Heine Sand. I know you've heard of him, Trevor.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of those names you have to say aggressively to keep people from laughing. And clearly I've seen
you got to hate when that happens.
Heine Sand is we've brought him up on this podcast, and I actually wrote about him. And actually on the last time we talked about him on this podcast, I talked about how I wrote about him. So just to give people a real quick refresher.
Talking about what you've done. And I'm sick of it.
He's flailing your accomplishments in my face. And I got to tell you, I'm taking the Stuffy McInnes approach on this, and I'm taking over this podcast.
Putting myself in as a defensive replacement.
Oh, my God.
Okay, now it's my turn.
It's really hard. Podcast. I can see why you were struggling so much.
Oh, boy. I don't know any of this information. Can you share your links?
Heine Sand is a name that people remember because in 2017, Odubel Herrera doubled in five straight games, and only two other Phillies had doubled in six straight, and they were Bobby Abreu in 2000 and Heine Sand in 1925. And that came up. And Heine Sand, he was part of a weird gambling issue during a right before a Giants Phillies game Heine Sand was approached and asked if he would not like come down hard on the Giants that day if they paid him $500, because I think the Giants were one win away from clinching the pennant. Tiny Sand said no, and he actually went on to score the Phillies' only run that day, even though the Giants won and won the pennant. Tiny Sand was not a man to be bought. So he let
that's
off.
That's a principled move by Tiny Sand, and I appreciate how completely toothless it was, and that he also lost.
Yes, but you know what?
It's pretty cool.
It's the principle of the thing, and I like to think that's the kind of guy Stuffy McInnes wanted on his team. And he paid off. Tiny Sand hit a double to start things off in the top of the eighth, followed by Fresco Thompson's single. And then, of course, Cy Williams struck out for the first out of the inning. But then Johnny Mockins came up, and he hit an RBI single, scoring Sand. Freddie Leach stepped in. He hit an RBI single, scoring Thompson. There was an error on the throw, so both runners moved into scoring position. Jimmy Wilson drew a walk. Bubber Jennard.
Come on.
I got to start reading these names beforehand.
Come on.
At this point, I'm gonna try to say it a different way. Bubber Jennard steps in. He hits an RBI double that clears the bases. And now the Phillies go up 5-4. At this point, you know, they have a couple more at bats, and they actually bat around, but then the inning ends. And they're up 5-4 by the end of the inning. And Stuffy McInnes's final playing appearance as a major league
Wow. Player. Well, that's so beautiful. I'm sure it's going to end up really well.
So pitching for the Phillies that day was Jack Scott. He had started the game. He would finish the game. Just to say that he would be finished by the game. He gave up all six runs. They were all earned. He only had two strikeouts. He gave up 16 hits, but the Phillies, you know, Stuffy McInnes left him in there. Jack Scott was just his guy that day. He wanted
soak it up, buddy.
He wanted Jack Scott on the mound for his final playing appearance in Major League Baseball. And Jack Scott sees the Phillies rally that inning. He sees his teammates string together a bunch of hits.
He's thinking, maybe I'll have a career.
He sees Bubber's bomb go over the fence in the right center, Bubber's double hit the fence in right center field. And he's just like, you know what? I'm going to do this. I've been screwing up all day. And I'm getting in there. I'm going back out, and I'm going to hold this lead, and this is going to be terrific. In fact, Stuffy McInnes is so behind his pitcher on this one. This is the moment that he puts himself in the game. He actually replaces Bubber Jennard and plays first base behind Jack Scott this inning, and it's huge. This is great. We're going to win. This is going to be terrific. And on the first batter Jack Scott faces is a man named Earl Webb, who, without considering any of the things I just said, hits a deep fly ball to right field and ties the game right the hell back up with a home run.
With Stuffy in the field, too. That's painful.
Yeah, so now it's 5-5 again. The Cubs don't score the rest of the inning. The Phillies come up. You know what? Hey, we did it once. We can do it again. The Phillies do not do it again. And they go down 1-2-3 in the top of the ninth. And that is followed by the bottom of the ninth. Jack Scott, I can do this for you, Skip. I swear I can get back out there and I can keep this game tied. And then you guys can come back out and score a run or something. And then I'll go back out and I will hold that lead for you exactly the way I did not hold it the previous time you gave me this opportunity.
And what happened? Scott,
he runs out there facing the number 9 batter in the Cubs lineup. And he gives up what every manager wants to see in that situation, a leadoff single. So he got a leadoff runner on first base. The next hitter grounds out, and they actually get the runner at second base. So the lead runner goes down, and Jack Scott's just like, yes, yes, okay. I screwed up once, but I can make this all right for you, Stuffy. I promise. He's looking over at first base, tears in his eyes. I'm going to do right by you, Skip.
Just giving a big thumbs up.
We got one out now. It's not a leadoff runner situation. Everything's fine. We just got two more of these. I swear to God, I got this. The next guy singles to center field, puts a runner in scoring position for Earl Webb, the guy who hit the home run on Jack Scott to lead off the bottom of the eighth and tie the game. And Jack Scott's just like, oh, fuck. No, no. All those dark thoughts. Get them out of your head. I got this. I'm going to do it for Stuffy. I'm going to keep us in this game. And Earl Webb hits a single to center field, scoring Adams. And the game is over because Jack Scott should not have been on the mound. And he leaves the mound that day, and he probably just goes and starts a pharmacy or something because he
I like imagining him. That was really well done. I like imagining him just walking off the mound directly into the clubhouse, just grabbing his shirt as he goes by, not stopping, not slowing, tossing his uniform in the bin, just like moving on and just like getting in a cab, driving out of the city and just starting his pharmacy right then. Just like one single movement. Like, yeah, you know what? It's time.
Cab pulls up to his parents' farm. They're just like, Jack, what are you doing here? And he just wordlessly sits down at the table, pours himself a glass of milk from a glass bottle, and then like goes out and starts working in the field. And they're confused because their son is a professional baseball player. He didn't want to work on the farm, but now he's like returned, and he just wordlessly starts. And then they find him, like he stays the night. They see him out there the next morning. He's back out there in the field. And then I thought they were playing in Philadelphia. What's going on? Nah, that's over for Jack. He doesn't. That looks of Stuffy McGinnis at first base. You got this, Jack. I believe in you. I didn't defensively insert myself into the game for no reason because I didn't believe in you. I wanted to literally have your back. Don't worry. I don't think Earl Webb is that good of a baseball player at all. I hope you got your fill of Stuffy, Trevor, because now it's time for dessert.
Ooh, and that I love dessert.
It's the best, frankly. It's really we're doing all of this just to get to the dessert, frankly. Trevor, what's your favorite pie on Thanksgiving?
I'm an apple pie kind of guy. I gotta say, it's very very standard. I'll eat the other pies. I don't really like pumpkin pie. I know that's a little weird, but I'm not a big pumpkin pie guy. I do like the pecan pie. I will absolutely enjoy that. And my grandmother used to make a really good cherry pie. My mom makes it too. So if that's on the table, I'll usually air that way. But the ones that are always there, apple, I'll go for. How about you?
My grandmother made a real mean Toll House pie. And
ooh,
that's
Toll House pies are nice.
That's a quality. Once I learned what that was because of her, it's the only thing I wanted anymore. My dad's a pumpkin pie fiend, but I'll be honest with you. I recently had a pumpkin pie cheesecake that I much preferred texture-wise to
pumpkin
pie.
People like pumpkin pie cheesecakes. People are really into those.
I'm thinking of making one and bringing it and then, you know, being alienated from my family for the rest of my adult life because, you know, of my father's very passionate feelings about pumpkin pie.
You got to go pumpkin chiffon, my friend.
Yeah, that's what my dad wants to hear. Dad, I took a foreign twist on an American classic.
Is your dad really like a super like traditional guy?
No, not at all.
Name's Chuck Clue. Put her there.
Put her there, unless you're not American. Well, Trevor, our slice of pie tonight comes courtesy of a man named Pie Trainer, who is, you know, very famous. Mm-hmm. Very famous baseball player. I believe he's in the – he's a very famous Pittsburgh Pirates manager. And
I'm just going to pretend I totally know who that is.
Oh, cool. I'm not finding out this information as I speak at all. No, he died in Pittsburgh at age 73 in 1972. He's buried in Pittsburgh. He played 17 years for the Pirates. He received MVP votes for 8 of those years. He was an all-star in 2 years.
Wow.
He led the league in triples in 1923 with 19 of them. And he also led the league in sacrifice bunts in 1927 and 1928 with 35 and 42, which are seems like a huge number of sacrifice bunts.
Yeah, for like a decent player, too.
But he played 17 years for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Then he went on to manage the Pirates from 1934 to 1939, which I know what you're thinking, and it's not really. And then he went on to manage the Pirates. While a player, he managed the Pirates, and then 2 years after his player career ended, he also managed them then as well.
Why was this so common? It never worked.
That's a good question. I mean, I wonder who the best player manager of all time was. That's a really good question, actually.
I'll start looking that up.
You know. We're going to talk about a game in 1930 involving Pie Trainer. because this was a game in which he, well, two games, actually. It was a doubleheader. His Pittsburgh Pirates played against the Philadelphia Phillies. And actually, for a doubleheader, you know what you love about doubleheaders? What everyone loves about doubleheaders is when one of the doubleheaders goes into extra innings and everyone
gets... Oh, yeah, that's always the best. I like when they're really long and then the other one, the other game lasts until an ungodly hour.
Yeah, it's just it's a teensy bit more of baseball that turns a full day of baseball into what feels like 6 days of baseball. It's
good. Hey, do you want to be really embarrassed by by the best player manager?
Always.
It's Connie Mack.
I knew it was going to be an easy one like that. I knew I was like, once I said the best, I was like, oh yeah, it's going to be somebody that we've obviously heard of.
Also, Cap Anson was a player manager for 23 seasons. Lou Boudreau won the MVP while he was a player manager.
Ooh, okay, that's a dandy. Nice.
Oh, and McGraw. So the two most famous managers maybe of all time were
player managers. I love how we, on a podcast that exclusively talks about terrible baseball, we're like, why have we never heard of any of the good player managers? It's almost like we exclusively talk about the worst, shittiest baseball games and therefore some of the, you know, lesser quality player managers as well.
Boy, there's a lot of cool things about like good baseball. So this will be the last one, I'll let you finish. But like John Montgomery Ward, who was a really old baseball player, threw a perfect game on June 12th, 1880, then became a player manager for the last 32 games of the 1880 season. So he just stopped. He's like, I did enough.
What you're saying is this is a question that two guys hosting a baseball podcast shouldn't have asked, and certainly shouldn't have asked while recording. And certainly
shouldn't have looked up while we were doing it live.
And certainly shouldn't have included it in the final cut of the podcast for everyone.
But I hope you will, because this was good. This was good information. Man, some of these names that George Sisler's there. We've talked about him. Frank Robinson, excuse me. Branch Rickey. Mel Ott. Boy, these are like a lot of the names that we talk about on the show, too. It's almost like we didn't prepare well at all.
Listen, Trev, do you want this pie or not, frankly? I'm starting to wonder.
Cy Young was a player manager. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
I'm starting to wonder if you even want this. I mean, I made this pie, and we're going to eat it.
Pie right? Trainer.
So by 1930, Pie Trainer, he's just had five seasons in a row where he was nominated for the MVP award. Did not win it, but five seasons in a row, he's coming off five really great seasons. And my God, if you look at his numbers – The lowest season batting average he had in that 5 year stretch was .317 with a .796 OPS. He hit .356 in 1929 with an .865 OPS in 130 games.
That's unbelievable.
Pretty solid. Well, you know what? 1930, he did even better. He actually hit .366 with a .932 OPS in 130 games in 1930, but before the season started, they weren't sure he was going to be able to hold the bat, frankly.
Really?
In spring training of 1930. This is from a Sabre article by James Foer. A nasty eye infection had Trainer on the sidelines for several weeks during the spring of 1930. It was so bad that he could hardly see out of his left eye. Thinking that the infection stemmed from another infection in his teeth, doctors resorted to pulling two teeth in hopes of clearing the bacteria from his system.
Old medicine is so bad.
Hang on. Even after his vision returned to full strength, Trainer still had to wear smoked glasses to protect his eye from the sunlight. He didn't return to the lineup full time until late May, but he compiled the highest batting average, .366, and on base percentage, .423, of his career. His most memorable day came in Philadelphia on July 23rd, Trev, when he hit a ninth inning home run to win the first game of a doubleheader, and then, for an encore, walloped a three-run homer in the 13th inning to win the night.
That's so brutal. Can you imagine going to those games? It can be like, I'm going to go see a doubleheader.
Well, it was 1930, so they were probably like, do you want to, like, take a shower today or, like, find a barrel so we could bathe in it? Or do you want to go to two baseball games in a row?
We got to go to these two baseball games. It costs 1 cent. And then if you work, you actually get one extra cent. So you're making money. That's about my week's wages.
Yeah, but then you got to pay them your 1 cent working fee back to your foreman. Ugh.
Man, this is terrible. I'm going to end up with a half cent by the end of the day, which I'll admit, doing pretty well.
No wonder they call it the Depression. I'm certainly depressed.
That is why they call it the Depression. People were really depressed.
I just want to say that the Phillies lost two games of a doubleheader to a guy who at the beginning of the season was blind and had two teeth ripped out of his head. They lost that game. Pitching for the Phillies that day, because it needs to be said, was a man named Snipe Hansen. pitching for the Pirates, because this also needs to be said, is another man named Heine. And his last name looks like his name could have been Heine Miney. It probably wasn't, but it reads like it could have been. And I don't think we should look it up to see what the correct pronunciation
was. Never. I'm not looking that one up. That's just going to be – that's what it is.
In any case, the first game of this doubleheader was something of a pinch-hitting duel. In that the first two runs were scored on RBI groundouts. I mean – the Phillies were down 1-0 due to an RBI groundout, and then they came back. And I got to tell you, Heine Miney is pitching to Don Hurst, and there's two runners on. There's two leadoff singles. One of them was Chuck Klein. The other one was Lefty O'Doul. Don Hurst comes up. He grounds out to shortstop. They get the force out at second, but O'Doul scores because of a throw from the shortstop to first. So I guess on the transfer of the double play – the throw goes bad, and Lefty O'Doul scores.
Weird.
And no RBI is recorded, and Don Hurst winds up on second. So that's what happened there. All right. And then finally, you know, it's 1-1 the whole game, and then Pie Trainer homers off Snipe Hansen in the top of the ninth to lead off, and the Phillies can't do anything with that, and they lose. So they lose 2-1 in game one of this doubleheader. It only took an hour and 40 minutes. Remember that. This is two baseball games in a row. Wow. It's not as formidable a concept as it is today.
Yeah, you may as well just watch two then. You basically just watched a Pixar movie.
However, the Phillies and Pirates in game two of this doubleheader have the exact opposite of a pitcher's duel and the exact opposite of a 2-1 win. They set a record for total at-bats and total bases in a single game.
Oh, wow.
Because this game ended in a 16-15 final score.
Oh, my word.
After 2-1, after most of that game was 1-1 because of an RBI groundout and once because of a throwing error. And in the second game, the Pirates had 23 hits. The Phillies had 27 hits and lost. Wow. They also committed three errors.
Wow, that's rough.
The Phillies scored in every inning from the fourth to the ninth. Both teams scored multiple runs in the 12th and 13th innings. So this game was out of control.
It sounds like that game from the 93 World Series.
That's exactly what I thought of as well, yeah. Because that first game, both teams had pitchers that just went the distance. This game, the Pirates went through four. The Phillies went through six, which I didn't even know teams had six pitchers back then. Maybe they didn't.
It was just some guy.
But yeah, they go back and forth all day long. And then finally, it's Pie Trainer who comes up in the top of the 13th. Because remember, the Pirates won both of these games as the away team in extra innings and then in the ninth inning in game one. Like,
wow.
The Phillies had a chance to win both of these games at home. It is so much easier to me for the home team to win in this situation. Like, I feel like I've over and over again, when the Phillies of recent memory have been in that situation, you just pencil it in as a loss, because it is so easy to lose when you are the away team.
Yes.
All they have to do is score a run. Like, that's it.
Yeah. And, it really is the, and I mean, like, the ninth inning works this way too, but like, it really is the, like, the ultimate, it's why home field advantage counts so much for baseball and, right, like, way more than in other sports.
Right. So in this case, there's two outs, two runners on, and Pie Trainer comes up and he crushes a home run, a three run home run with a score tied 13-13, and the Pirates go up 16-13. Now in the next inning, So first of all, the Phillies start off with two strikeouts. So already there's two outs. They're down by three runs in the bottom of the 13th on a game where they've had no trouble scoring any other really moment in this game. So, but now there's two outs, game's on the line. Lefty Odul comes up facing a Pirates pitcher, Larry French. Okay. He singles to right field. And then with Chuck Klein batting, Odul steals second base with defensive indifference. Then he steals third base with defensive indifference. Then Chuck Klein singles, and Lefty Odul comes in to score, making it 16-14. Okay. So now Chuck Klein is on first base. With Don Hurst batting, Chuck Klein steals second base with defensive indifference.
Seems like things are going pretty well for the Phillies.
Then Chuck Klein steals third base with defensive indifference. Hmm. This is the most indifference defense I think you can apply.
They were just like, yeah, forget it.
For a game in which the Phillies had scored 13 runs prior to this inning, they were really not worried about the Phillies scoring three runs in one inning. But they had already scored one. Then Don Hurst doubles, and Klein comes in and scores. And Don Hurst is sitting there in scoring position. Now the lead now 16-15. Pinky Whitney for the Phillies comes up, and Larry French manages to get him to just weakly ground back to the pitcher and get thrown out at first base. So Pie Trainer gets to be the hero in Philadelphia two games in a row. He crushes a pair of home runs that wins his Pirates the game, which I also wanted to point out. Pie. So that, Trev, I hope with two helpings of turkey, a helping of stuffing, and a slice of pie. Well, two slices of pie. I hope that was enough.
I'm stuffed. This truly was the information version of Thanksgiving. I enjoyed every bit of it, and now I need to go to sleep.
I honestly, the tryptophan's kicking in, and I am stuffed to the brim with hot information. And I can't wait to take all of this back to my family's Thanksgiving table and tell them exactly what I've learned here today while they talk loudly over me about more important things. We appreciate your listening to not only the Dirty Inning, but every member of the Good Fight podcast family. And that includes Hittin' Season with myself, John Stolness, and Liz Rocher, where we talk about Phillies items of the day. And with a pretty important Phillies offseason in front of us, I think that's going to be a pretty critical podcast for anyone who has even a passing interest in the Phillies to pay attention to in the coming months, as well as continued success, on which Liz Rocher and I will be not only just talking about the Phillies, but baseball in general, and also probably breaking into some new territory that we've been discussing that we're really excited about. So keep going to The Good Fight for all of your Phillies coverage. We've got great original content appearing on The Good Fight every day. And yeah, like I said, subscribe, download, and rate all your favorite podcasts on The Good Fight. We benefit from all of the attention you can pay us. Thank you for listening to The Dirty Inning, and we wish you a very happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Hello, I'm Spencer Hall from SB Nation, and I want to tell you about my new show, It Seems Smart. It Seems Smart is a show about people doing things that, for some reason or another, seem smart at the time. Those things might include doing a little cocaine and driving a bike up a mountain. Or, I don't know, maybe racing 100 miles per hour across the country in the middle of the night with no one's permission. Or even stealing a bat from an umpire's room in a Major League Baseball park. Check it out, and if you like it, tell a friend. I'm Spencer Hall. Don't do anything smart.